It was about 4 o'clock on the 10th of May 1941 when my father arrived at the Messerschmitt airfield in Augsburg. And after having ordered to prepare the plane, he gave an envelope to his adjutant Pinch, which contained a letter to Hitler. And he then went to the plane and set off for on a mission of peace, which still is one of the great mysteries of the Second World War. He knew all the details about the flight and the intentions of making peace with Britain. And since he's not anymore alive, we might never know about these important things for history.
The flight of Rudolf Hess from Augsburg to the hills of Scotland in May 1941 remains one of the greatest mysteries in military history. This documentary traces that story through his son Wolf Rudiger Hess, who today lives in Munich. And we begin in Munich in May 1921 when one man was plotting a new Germany. His name, Adolf Hitler.
I can tell you what my mother tells me, that she lived together with him in those days in the same hotel, and she tells that he came home one evening excited very much and saying, "I've met the man who is going to break the Versailles chains," and this was Hitler, and he has met him in a small meeting. In those days it was not the big national party, it was a very small organization of about, let's say, 20 people or so. And Hitler had delivered a speech there, and my father listened to this speech, and he was completely excited and came home and told my mother, "You must come with me the next time and see this man."
Rudolf Hess became member number 16 of the National Socialist Party. He quickly became a follower and a friend of Hitler, and they were both imprisoned in November 1923 following an attempted coup against the German government.
Hitler trusted my father very obviously, and I think the close connection between the two men came when they were both in Landsberg prison. They were together every day, and Hitler wrote by typing itself himself into the machine Mein Kampf, and he used my father as a sort of sounding board and to check whether it was understandable for the public.
By 1929, the National Socialist Party had become a mass movement. Within 4 years, that mass movement had swept Hitler to power. And one of his first appointments was to make Rudolf Hess a government minister and deputy Führer of the party.
He had to lead the party, he had to watch that laws which came out were in line with the party ideals, and he was called the conscience of the party.
Dank Ihrer Führung.
Hess quickly became a leading party spokesman, and in this rare recording is heard introducing party leaders at a rally in Berlin.
Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt.
Then, in 1937, his only child was born. He was christened Wolf Rudiger Hess in the presence of his godfather, Adolf Hitler, but Wolf Rüdiger would have few memories of his father.
Der Garant des Friedens, Adolf Hitler!
Yes, I've been a child of 3.5 years, and I have only two recollections, both which are connected with drastic situation. The one is that I dropped in our garden pool and could not swim, of course, in those ages. And my father was in the vicinity of the pool, and he took me out, and I still can very much remember to see how his hand came and grabbed me and took me out. The other thing was, I was lying in bed one evening, and a bat came through the window and caught herself in my hair, and I screamed like hell, and my father came into the room and took the bat out of my hair and let it out of the window.
Do you remember Hitler from this time?
No, not at all.
Yet he was your godfather.
He was my godfather, and he was also at our home in Hallaching in 1938, when there was a festival of my name-giving.
On September the 1st, 1939, Hitler attacked Poland. 2 days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany. Hess was concerned at the escalating violence that a spreading war would bring in its wake.
Yeah, mainly about the warfare against civil persons, with the bombing of the cities, and he said that he can very much imagine the situation, how it's going to come, seeing rows of children coffins with weeping women behind it, and all the other way around, seeing rows of coffins of women with weeping children behind it.
Next to fall was Denmark, Norway, then France. But behind the scenes, attempts were made at reaching peace with Britain. Contacts were established with British Conservative Party peers, including the Scottish Duke of Hamilton. And at the centre of the German peace efforts was Rudolf Hess.
Yes, there were a lot of contacts, and my father used Albrecht Haushofer, the son of his best friend, Professor Karl Haushofer, who had known the Duke of Hamilton from before the war. And the Albrecht Haushofer and the Duke of Hamilton exchanged letters with these peace initiatives.
And this was very much with your father's blessing?
Of course it was, with even Hitler's blessing.
In May 1941, Rudolf Hess decided to strike for peace himself. It was a bold initiative whereby Hess would fly to Britain on his own, make contact with the Duke of Hamilton in Scotland, and then return to Germany, having presented his conditions for peace. It was an extraordinary plan devised by Hitler's deputy Führer.
The day my father left, the 10th of May 1941, he came around noon into the bedroom of my mother. She lay in bed because she was not too well on this day, and my mother immediately recalled that he wear a blue shirt rather than a white shirt, and she always wanted him to wear blue shirts because she was of the opinion that blue shirts are much better for him, and he's looking much better. And she asked him, "Why do you wear a blue shirt today?" And he said, "It's just nothing to say, it's just a mood."
Did he tell your mother where he was going?
No, of course not.
What did he say?
He said, "I've got to go to Berlin, and I might be away for 1 or 2 days or even longer."
Accompanied by his adjutant, Lieutenant Karl-Heinz Pinch, Rudolf Hess set off by car for Augsburg. Here was located a Messerschmitt production plant manufacturing fighter and bomber aircraft for the Luftwaffe. The plant also contained an airfield and a Messerschmitt 110, which was assigned to Rudolf Hess.
They reached the Messerschmitt airfield, and he asked that the plane is fully fueled and everything is prepared for the long flight. And he gave Pinch, his adjutant, an envelope and said, "If I'm not back within 4 hours, then you take this envelope to Hitler." Pinch later told that they were sitting all together in the office of one of the Messerschmitt people, and time went on, and after 4 hours they opened, as my father had said, the outer side of the envelope, and they found a paper in there that he's on his way to Britain.
It was shortly after 7 p.m. when Lieutenant Pinch left the Messerschmitt airfield at Augsburg, taking with him the letter for Hitler. He travelled by car and train to Hitler's country residence, and he arrived before midnight.
Yeah, Pinch went to the Berchtesgaden, to the Obersalzberg, and gave Hitler, after some waiting time, the letter, and Hitler read it and started screaming at Pinch, and you did know all about this. And Pinch, according to what really happened, said yes. And I think Hitler was aware that my father is going to fly to Britain, but he played a good role in after receiving this letter, to be very much surprised by it.
Yes, indeed, because Pinch, of course, was arrested, and many other people too.
Yes, Pinch and his secretaries and other adjutants were arrested, but you have to bear in mind that Hitler never did anything against the family, and the father of my father died in October 1941, and Hitler wrote a letter of condolence to my grandmother.
Yet at the same time, Hitler issued a communique saying that your father was mentally unstable.
Yeah, I think this was not done by Hitler. It was done by his press adjutants. And it's known in the meantime that Goebbels got furious about this, because he said he put the finger right into the wound, saying, aha, now the people say we are run by mad people. Which of course was right. It was also the reaction of the public.
So it backfired.
It backfired, yes.
The North Sea sky that Saturday night was crystal clear, the silence broken only by the sound of a Messerschmitt bomber and its pilot, Rudolf Hess. By 10 p.m., he crossed the coast of Scotland and then began to search for a place to land.
Yeah, I think that he originally intended, or had the information, that he was going to land somewhere, because it's not possible to imagine that a man who prepared this flight down to the last detail forgets about the most important thing at the end, how to get out by parachute of this plane. And you can see the last miles of his flight, when the course is printed on the map, is rather zigzag, and so he got in a way lost. And then he described in a letter how he tried to get out of the plane, that he opened the screen and was pressed by the air pressure to his seat and couldn't get out, and so, and then finally he got the plane to a standstill in shooting it up to the sky, and the engines were not possible to cut off, because they were too overheated, so they continued to run. Anyhow, he succeeded finally to get the plane to a standstill for a short moment, where he could drop out, then landed by parachute in Flores Farm Field in south of Glasgow.
It was just after 11 p.m. on the night of May the 10th when the Deputy Führer landed by parachute on British soil. He landed 12 miles from the home of the Duke of Hamilton, and within minutes he was confronted by a local farm worker, David McLean.
This ploughman of Flores Farm, Mr. McLean, got aware of the crash of the plane, and he looked out and saw my father still caught by the parachute. He went out and taking a fork with him as a weapon, and saw my father and asked him who you are, and my father said, I'm German officer on a peace mission, and please bring me to the Duke of Hamilton.
There was, of course, no Duke of Hamilton.
No, there was no Duke of Hamilton, because Duke of Hamilton was sitting in Turnhouse Airfield and was not at home.
And do you believe he was aware that Hess was arriving?
Yes, absolutely, because it is known that the Duke of Hamilton in the afternoon started a plane and went out and up to the sky in order to find my father coming.
So what had gone wrong?
This is a big question. I think this is still buried in the documents, which are classified until 2017.
Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed.
The following morning, the British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, received a message that Rudolf Hess had landed in Scotland. That morning also, the Duke of Hamilton was brought to meet Hess at Maryhill Barracks, where he was now under arrest. But Churchill showed no interest in discussing peace with the Deputy Führer. To Churchill, the war was turning in Britain's favour, the Blitz had been endured, the Battle of the Skies was won, and there were rumours that America would soon enter the war. Churchill quickly imposed a news blackout on the Hess visit.
Yes, Churchill was able to steer the whole case as being Prime Minister, and he, of course, knew that he should not tell the British people the real reason why my father came, so he just shut him away, or locked him away.
And literally for the next 4 years of the war, your father was hardly heard of again?
Yes, I think there was nothing, with the exception of a question in the House in 1943, where somebody asked whether now the real background of the trip of Mr. Hess could be told. There was nothing at all.
But the question remained as to what had gone wrong. For example, would a German government minister and Hitler's deputy Führer fly to enemy territory without some arrangement or commitment in place? Was Hess expecting to be met? And were the British aware he was coming? There have been many, many theories over the decades, but more recently, evidence has come to light implicating the British Secret Service.
Yes, we know in the meantime that MI6 was involved in the trap business with my father up to their neck, but not in order to just lure Hess to Britain in order to make it difficult for Germany, but they very obviously intended to get my father to Britain as a sort of an ignition to overthrow the Churchill government.
And why would they want to do this?
Because they were very much conservative people in MI6, and they were of the opinion that this war between Britain and Germany only would lead to destruction of Europe.
And they would, of course, have had many contacts with the likes of the Duke of Hamilton.
Yes, of course. They were also involved in the so-called peace party in Britain. There were a lot of influential people, starting from Lloyd George down to the Duke of Hamilton and other people, who were of the opinion that making peace with Germany is much better for the British Empire than continuing the war and becoming the junior part of America.
So what exactly would your father's arrival achieve in that respect?
I think that they needed, from the peace party, they needed a sort of a push. And if my father, the deputy Führer, arrives in the country and says, we want peace in Germany, why don't you follow us, British people? If to the British public in May 1941 it was really known that Hess arrived in order to make peace, it would have been went over the country like a bush fire over a dry step. I think this was the idea from MI6 with the arrival of my father.
Throughout the war years, Hess was imprisoned in various locations in Britain, including a spell in the Tower of London. He had virtually disappeared without trace until 1945, that is, when the Germans surrendered.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m.,
at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl signed the act of unconditional surrender.
5 months later, in October 1945, the 51-year-old Hess was transferred by plane to Nuremberg in Germany, ironically taking the same route that he took in 1941 in his Messerschmitt 110.
Bevor ich die Frage des Gerichtshofes beantworte.
Then at 10 a.m. on the 20th of November, the Nuremberg Tribunal proceedings began. 21 defendants, including Hess, were instructed to enter their pleas of guilty or not guilty.
Ich bekenne mich im Sinne der Anklage nicht schuldig.
Rudolf Hess.
Nein.
That will be entered as a plea of not guilty.
He did not recognize the court, and he had to show this in all his actions, to demonstrate it in all his actions. And there also, if he would have defended himself, he would have given some justice to the court.
He was convicted finally of crimes against peace.
Yes, he was accused of all four, and he was expressively exonerated. On the two criminal charges, which were war crimes and crimes against humanity.
The sentence was life in prison, and in the summer of 1947, Hess was transferred to Spandau Prison in the outskirts of Berlin. He, along with six other prisoners, Speer, Funk, Rader, von Schirach, von Neurath and Donitz, travelled by plane to Berlin, viewing on the way the ruins of the city that lay beneath. He became prisoner number 7 in Spandau, and in this former 19th century prison, the 7 Nazi leaders were detained in primitive conditions.
He never wrote about it, but we knew from other people that would have been released, especially Speer and Schirach. And you could call them drastically inhuman. He had a cell of 9 by 8 feet and a wooden bed with no mattress rather than a straw and a table and a stool. And the window was high above themselves under the ceiling, so they could see only the sky and nothing else.
And what about possessions? Did he have them with him?
Yeah, to my knowledge, he was allowed one toothbrush, and that's it.
And what about talking to the other prisoners who were there?
They were not allowed to talk among themselves. They were, I think they were allowed on certain days and certain times to go into the garden together. But when they wanted to talk, they were punished afterwards.
Did they have prison work?
Yes, they had to glue envelopes and work in the garden. Humorous story told by Speer to me that my father was asked by the warders to water some place of the garden, and he said, "I have nothing to do with the water. We have two admirals here. They can do it. They know how to work with water."
How many hours a day were they locked in their cell?
I think almost the whole day, and they only had very narrow times when they were allowed to get out.
And of course, no contact with the outside world.
Of course, no, nothing, absolutely nothing. In the beginning also, it was not allowed to write letters, for example.
So the conditions really were appalling.
Yes, you could say this.
For the next 22 years in Spandau, Hess received no visits from his family. This was by his own wish, arguing that his conditions were degrading and his imprisonment unjust. Eventually, he was permitted to write letters to his mother, to his wife, and to his son, including one letter to his wife on the 21st of October, 1951, having been informed of the death of his mother.
My dear ones, I thank you from my heart of the gentle way you informed me of the so tragic news. So it has happened, after all, the inconceivable. I had, of course, to reckon with this, but I still hoped she might be with us for a few more years and that we would see each other again, as she also believed. I am unspeakably glad to know that at least she was not conscious of her false hopes and that she passed peacefully away, without a struggle and without the pain of parting from you, the children, the loved little grandson, and her faraway eldest child.
What exactly would your father write about in the letters that he wrote subsequently to you and your mother?
He would touch on almost every theme you could imagine. And he was a very, very knowledgeable person, and he could talk about almost everything. And he did do this in his letters.
And he asked about you a lot.
He asked about me a lot, and he also tried to educate me through his letters. For example, he once wrote to me that what you are doing is in the end not so important, but it is important that you do it with all your energy and with all your commitment.
Did he ever complain in these letters?
No, never.
And did he ever talk about his possible release in the future?
Yeah, of course, he always said that he is of the opinion that he should be released, and I think he hoped up to his last day that he would be released.
Throughout the 1950s, von Neurath, Radar, Donitz and Funk were released one by one from Spandau. Then, on the 30th of September 1966, Speer and von Schirach were also released, leaving Rudolf Hess on his own in the Spandau fortress.
In what way I went through those three dreadful days when I knew that the other two were packing their things baffles me. One of my retired colleagues asked me whether what was happening got on my nerves, to which I replied that of course it was not exactly a pleasure to watch the others packing their things while mine remained entirely unpacked. I told them to get on and finish it, so that peace would prevail once again.
Yes, he was the only man in this big, huge prison, and this was a sort of a solitary confinement which was without any example, if you take our modern times and not medieval times.
He had nobody to talk to all of a sudden.
With the exception of the French priest, which came to see him every week for 1.5 hours, there was no people to really talk to, yes.
Was he breaking or cracking under the pressure?
I would say no. This is one of the astonishing sides of my father, that he, under these very heavy strain, did not break.
For the next 3 years, Hess lived in solitary confinement, his only company being the birds in the prison yard. Then, in 1969, he formally contacted the Spandau Directorate, requesting a visit from his wife and his son.
I request a visit from my wife and son, if possible on the morning of the 24th December. It is the first visit for 28 years, and I therefore request that no witnesses be present in the room at the beginning of the visit. The conversation I will conduct with my family can be recorded on tape. I also promise that I will not shake hands with them, and my family will make a similar promise. I request that it be taken into account that in the course of 20 years, von Schirach and Speer received a large number of visits, but that this is my first. I therefore also ask that, since it will last only half an hour, we be allowed to take Christmas lunch together.
Can you describe what it was like meeting him for the first time?
Yes, he received us in a room which was separated by partitions, and he sat on one side of the table and we sat on the other side. Behind us were sitting the four directors, and he received us by saying to me, what a tall chap you are. I didn't recall this from the pictures I received. And there was, of course, a sort of emotional breakout, but I was able to control it by making jokes.
And how did he look? What did his condition look like?
Yeah, he was recovering from a very bad illness. He had a perforated ulcer in the duodenum. And for the circumstances he was in and the illness he went through, he looked quite well.
You couldn't, of course, touch him, could you?
No, of course not.
So there was no possibility of a handshake?
No. This was completely forbidden.
But surely after 28 years of not seeing your father, it must have almost happened naturally that you'd reach out to touch him.
Yeah, and in a way I learned to know my father the first time in those days. But my mother, knowing him from the earlier days, also followed this natural reaction and stretched out her hand. And I said to him, to her, be aware, it's not allowed. But I made use of this natural behavior. One or two visits later, still in the hospital, that I came in and stretched out my hand, and my father reacted immediately and gave me his hand, and the directors sitting behind were really taken off their feet.
What did you talk about on this first visit?
I had set up sort of a script for the half hour. Was imagining that there would be a outbreak of emotions, and so I had jokes prepared. There was once a situation where my mother was about to start weeping or screaming, and I just covered this by interrupting and telling the joke, and so it was for me a difficult and not an emotional visit.
Did you bring presents for your father?
No, we were not allowed.
And your conversation, of course, was being listened to by the four directors throughout.
Of course, they were listening throughout, and they also had the... there was a water also within the room, and the water started 5 minutes before the time was over to say still 5 minutes and still 4 minutes and still 3 minutes. My father became very angry about this and then interrupted when he started saying still 3 minutes and said, okay, it's good enough now.
And do you remember departing?
Yeah, of course. We went out and looked back in the door and saw him standing there a little bit bowed already, and greeting with his hands, and we went out into the freedom, and he still was kept there.
In the following years, Wolf Rudiger Hess made 102 visits to his father in Spandau. He was never permitted to touch his father, to discuss the war, or to ask personal questions, and the visits were always monitored by the Spandau directors. Other visits were made to Hess by his wife and his lawyer, Dr. Seidel. Then, in 1987, Rudolf Hess reached the age of 93, and on the 17th of August of that year, Wolf Rudiger Hess received some bad news.
I was in the office and I got the telephone call from a reporter that who told me that something very serious must have happened to my father. He even might be dead.
So what did you do?
I went home and called Dr. Seidel to come here, and then in the evening at, I think, 6:30 or so, Mr. Keane, the American director, who is the same name as you, he called me and said, Mr. Hess, I'm allowed to tell you that your father expired at 4 p.m. this day. I'm not allowed to give you any details.
Eventually, a formal statement was issued to the effect that Rudolf Hess had committed suicide. The statement said that he hanged himself with a piece of cable in the Spandau garden shed while unattended. Yet many doubted that a frail 93-year-old would have the strength or dexterity to do just that. And no one was allowed to see the evidence.
No, they did not allow neither Dr. Seidel nor me, Dr. Seidel is his lawyer, to see the evidence, to see the cable, to see the hut or so. The cable there, Mr. Letizier, the British director, told Dr. Seidel that he personally destroyed it, and the hut was destroyed one or two days after his death.
So the evidence was all gone?
The evidence was all gone, and they were, the directors were themselves trying, especially the British, to destroy them.
There had been much debate as to whether the four powers would return Hess's body to his family. Yet, after an autopsy, the body was returned, and that brought a new twist to the story.
The body was released to us after the autopsy was carried out, and they did, of course, not expect that we from the family would conduct the second autopsy.
And what was the result of that?
The result of that was that he had marks on his neck which were not pointing to suicide, but which were pointing to throttling.
With murder, in other words.
With murder, in other words. And if you hang yourself, the marks lead to a peak at the back of your neck. But in my father's case, they were without any peak, and they were just going around.
This verdict of murder was again confirmed by Dr. Hugh Thomas, a former British Army doctor who had examined Hess in Spandau. This time, based on photographic evidence, he suggested that Hess was killed by strangulation, not by hanging. But who could have done it? According to the Hess family, it was the British who did it for one simple reason.
Because the Russians were, in the spring of 1987, gave indication that they were ready to release him. And this is the last the British government would like to see, because then he could talk openly about all the still unknown facts behind his flight to Britain.
They didn't want him out?
No, definitely, they didn't want him out.
And you think this is all documented now somewhere in Britain?
Yeah, very obviously, because they still keep the documents concerning the flight of my father classified or hidden until the year 2017.
In his final years, Rudolf Hess lived a solitary existence in the fortress of Spandau, a sole prisoner in a prison built to hold 600. He was guarded by four world powers: Britain, France, America, and the Soviet Union. 128 military guards with six watchtowers manned by soldiers armed with machine pistols. And inside that fortress, the loneliest prisoner in the world was awaiting his freedom.
Yes, I think he had an image of how he would conduct his life being freed, living in a family home in the Alps, where my mother lived, and having his books and his reading material around him, and being able to go out and all these things. And he had no intention to enter politics at all. He even wrote a letter to the directors in promising that he did not intend to enter into politics. So he was absolutely no political threat. He was no threat to anybody. He was an old, ailing man, and only having one hope in his mind, that he could see his grandchildren.
In his last days, Hess was partly blind, gaunt, stooped, and feeble. He'd suffered a stroke and heart failure, and above all, he suffered from the effects of isolation and loneliness. His was a life sentence, not for war crimes or crimes against humanity, but for crimes against peace. Even Lord Shawcross, who was one of the chief prosecutors at Nuremberg, argued in 1970 that Hess's continued imprisonment was contrary to all notions of justice.
If you take into consideration that he originally risked his life to make peace in his flight to Britain, and then was convicted because of crimes against peace to life imprisonment, and was treated in a very inhuman way, you only can say that is a disgrace. And my father was put into solitary confinement of the worst possible kind, and In the end, they murdered him because they didn't want to let him out. So the whole story of Rudolf Hess is something which will be remembered for decades or centuries.
Today, Spandau Prison is gone. Its last inmate, prisoner number 7, gone too. His son, Wolf Rüdiger, still lives in Munich, a retired engineer in his late 50s. He campaigns in defense of his father, and he awaits the year 2017 when the files will finally be opened. Perhaps resolving, once and for all, the mystery of that historic flight from Augsburg to Scotland on that warm, clear evening in May 1941.
It's still one of the great mysteries of the Second World War, and a lot of things are still undiscovered, and if you have things like this, you open the door for guessing. And now, after the death of my father, it might well be that it becomes the great mystery of all times.